This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good. It's nice to see some familiar faces here today. Thank you for coming. I've been thinking a lot about the environment lately, and so my talk will be a little bit about that. First, I thought I'd start with the first part of Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, which is his instruction for sitting. And it starts with Dogen's fundamental question. It's the question that drove him to China to seek another teacher. He was a Tendai monk, and he was approved by his teacher in the Tendai sect, but it just wasn't enough for him. He still had this burning question, and so he expresses it very well in this first part of this Fukan Zazengi. He says, "The way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent upon practice and realization? The Dharma vehicle is free and untrammeled. What need is there for concentrated effort? Indeed, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from one, right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice?" So going off here and there to practice used to be an option for us, but lately it hasn't been. So we're forced to practice in place. It's kind of a wonderful opportunity for us to connect more deeply with our Zen practice. And yet it still can be quite challenging to do so because our homes are full of our distractions. And sometimes we get used to the fact that we can just go somewhere else, away from our home, away from all the things of our life, all the piles of books and papers and the computer, the internet, all these things that distract us, the kitchen, the refrigerator. So now we get this opportunity to settle into our actual homes and practice. And it might be easy for some of us, it might be really hard for others. And yet, it's kind of, there's an equal, it's all equal. The amount of effort, what I'm trying to say is, sometimes obstacles appear and it just takes effort to move through them to get to the place where the effort just easily comes forth. But then you can't take that space for granted either, because another obstacle will inevitably arise. So it's important to just keep going and embrace this idea of continuous practice, that it is indeed possible for continuous practice. And that's what Dogen's touching upon when he says the way is basically perfect and all-pervading. And yet we still get angry, we still get caught in negative ways of thinking. We get caught in our imperfections, and so we find this need to go to the cushion and stop and be still. A lot of people turn to meditation in order to get something from it. Whether it's a reduction in stress in your life, or to find more happiness in your life, to improve your relationships. There's lots of science data that backs up these benefits that meditation provides for us. I myself turned to meditation when I was a teenager. I had problems with food. I had a few years of anorexia that had turned into bulimia, that had turned into extreme social withdrawal, and just this desire to be perfect, which of course I couldn't be, made me spiral into a kind of very dark depression. And my mom sent me off to a psychiatrist, and you know, after he was a Freudian psychiatrist, and I just sat on his couch and cried. And after a few sessions, I'm like, Mom, you're wasting your money. I'm just crying. And so, and the psychiatrist realized this too. And he was like, you know, why don't we just put your daughter on an antidepressant? And so I was given like an MAO inhibitor and said, you know, I just wasn't going to school. And I was like, okay, you're on your meds, go back to school. And I was actually much more able to deal with my life, deal with social interactions and myself after, you know, with that, but I still didn't like having to take medication. So I found out about meditation by reading some books that my brother had in his room. And he had gone to Japan to study Aikido. So I just like had, and my other brother was at school in Georgia. And so I kind of had free reign of the house and my brother's books. So my brother had Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, and The Snow Leopard, which I actually gave to my mom for Christmas when it came out. And I read that, and that was the book that made me look at the Dharma as an answer. So why did I think that the Dharma would be the answer? It's a good question. It looked like the kind of race to compete in the world just kind of never led to anywhere. And when I was a senior in high school, it felt that way. I went to Palo Alto High School. It was a pretty competitive environment. I was in AP classes and with all the, you know, it was very competitive. And of course, that was I graduated in 1980. And so, I mean, in the years following, it just has become much, much, much worse, to the extent that kids were regularly at Pali, the railroad tracks run right by Palo Alto High School, and kids were throwing themselves on the tracks because they couldn't, you know, make it. So that could have been me, you know, if I'd been born 10 years later, 15 years later, I might have been following some of those kids and ending my life. So I think that at that time, that it's a very difficult time of life for many people. So I think I actually wandered into a workshop that I there was a flyer up. I used to actually go hang out at the Lucy Stern Community Center, where they had like a community theater and stuff. And there was a flyer up there that Stephen Levine was giving a workshop on death and dying. And I was just a high school senior. I don't know why I thought a workshop on death and dying was gonna help, though I was actually maybe a little suicidal, so that could have been part of it. And Stephen Levine told us, you know, this is how to meditate, you know, that meditation can help you with being with people who are dying, or being with a cancer diagnosis, or, you know, or a suicide wish. So he taught us how to sit Vipassana, and that was my introduction to meditation, beyond the books that I'd read. So I did find it helped a lot. And so I embraced it. But then the certain point down the road, I realized after experiencing being in with two sanghas where the teacher self-destructed, that maybe meditation wasn't the right thing. And I kind of put myself down thinking that that I was just self-medicating with meditation, and because of the disappointment of that. You know, you look up to a teacher and you think, wow, you know, they've put their life together through this life of meditation. So why am I meditating? It clearly doesn't work. It clearly leads to trouble. But nevertheless, you know, I continued, and I think part of it is the practice itself. So really, by that point, I'd been told many, many times, you know, don't wish for anything, don't sit with a gaining idea. Even the thought, you know, the ultimate goal of meditation is, you know, to understand our oneness and interconnectedness to all things. To understand kind of how everything just is, this experience that we feel of, you know, time moving, of our thoughts moving, are just, it's like water flowing into this ocean of oneness. Like our life stream or our thought stream are all part of this watershed that runs into the great Dharma ocean, and it all mixes up, it all touches, every molecule touches each other. I don't know, these are all conceptual ideas for this state that I think informs Buddhism itself. That idea is that profound realization is what the Buddha spent his life, you know, spent the great energy of his youth to find, and then the rest of his life to teach. That's basically whether we know it or not, I think the truth that underlies our existence. I don't know, there's no science to prove that, I suppose, but I think it's true. So this effort to connect to this awareness of oneness, that's what That's what we use to bring us to the cushion. So, you know, really all the effort we need to make is, well, it's not really true, but I think the big bulk of the effort is to actually get on the cushion itself. Or if you don't sit on a cushion, to your chair or your meditation space, your meditation posture. And then the rest of the effort is just to be with what you're experiencing and to try to notice it as a moment-to-moment experience. To notice your breath, to notice your body, to notice the sight, the light, the sounds, just the embodiment of your being in this moment. And that can also be like wandering into your thoughts of the future or thoughts of the past, or even just I'm experiencing that thought, I'm experiencing, and I'm experiencing this in my body. And so that, I think, is where we look. And then we are, if we are good meditators, we apply some curiosity to that experience. Like, what is it? You know, like the emotion. Oh, what is this? You know, what is this feeling? You know, what is this emotional state? How is it feeling in my body? Or even what am I? Or what is my, why do I have a story? There's so many questions or koans that appear while we sit. So part of this sitting, this stopping, is a kind of paring down. So we can just like get down to the essence of this moment, paring down. Oh, it's a thought. Is it a necessary? Is it necessary for me to think about breakfast tomorrow morning? No, or breakfast this morning, depending on when we're sitting. So, okay, I'll pare that away. It's not necessary. Just this moment, just this moment. And that pares down to just a very, you know, like we need very little in this space of zazen. We just need our attention. Maybe it calls for more. Maybe it calls for us, you know, like if we're really sleepy, it calls for us to invigorate some energy or just to be tolerant, you know, the energy, the effort to be tolerant with our sleepiness or to be tolerant with the experience that we're having if it's unpleasant, you know, that it's just there. And can we sit with it? And then eventually we can look at our feeling of lack. So this feeling that we have within us that is that we're lacking something. So again, as Dogen says, the way is basically perfect and all-pervading. The whole body is far beyond the world's dust. It is never apart from one, right where one is. So he's saying we don't lack anything, that we're just okay, everything, we have everything. And this is really important, I think, for us to understand. There's, of course, things we need. We need food to sustain our body. We need the companionship of other people and of our friends and our animal friends. We need nature. We need fresh air, clean air. We need a house. We need shelter. We need a home. if we're homeless, if we're monks and we're taken up the call to leave our home, obviously we still need a shelter, and we have this home of our body to look after. So home is a relative concept, but it's an important one. And I think when we sit, we're actually, in a sense, returning to our home. So these are things that we need, but they're not big needs. They're not like a new iPhone or a big steak. So I think in this time of pandemic, this is a good point in our life to start looking at our wants and our desires and seeing, well, which ones are the ones we want to nurture, which desires, which needs do we want to nurture, and which ones do we want to set aside for the sake of a better planet, for the sake of a better, healthier life, and really for us who've taken the vow, for the sake of all beings, you know, what do we need to put aside? And thinking of the Dharma ocean, where everything dissolves into one, I think about the state of our own oceans on our planet Earth, and where all of the plastic that's going into these oceans is breaking down into tinier and tinier pieces, but never really dissolving into something that's friendly to the environment, but just still these little tiny pieces of plastic that are pervading the life chain, getting into all the organisms that feed one upon each other. And a recent study showed that that plastics are breaking down above the water as well, and tiny, tiny pieces that are just getting into the atmosphere and being blown around. And this woman who did some studies in the national parks and protected areas in the West found, you know, in her soil samples, just on the surface, just lots and lots of very tiny pieces of plastic. And she estimated in her studies that there's 1,000 tons per year of plastic particles that are blowing into protected areas in the Western United States. It's just a small portion of the billions of tons of plastic that we're generating today. And, you know, I wonder, we're developing this fear around the pandemic so that we're becoming sensitized to the space around each other's mouth and nose where we breathe, and this aerosolized area that could possibly contain a virus that would be lethal, perhaps. What if we had a fear to plastic? So when we walked into a store and saw food that is packaged in plastic, that we instinctively pull back from it and refuse to buy it. Maybe that would be what we need, because we've just developed this tolerance to all the plastic that is in our consumer culture, our lives. It's hard to go shopping now. And now, especially with the virus, where we can't even use our own bags. So this is a problem I'm wrestling with. These Dharma, you know, oceans around our planet that have been so generous in receiving our toxic pollution or getting saturated. So how do we look after them? And it just occurs to me that really the first step is to return to our cushions and be with the moment and receive everything that we receive. So we create this kind of spaciousness in our mind, body, that allows us to receive things. That it means like we have this basket of life which is full, and we're able to share it more easily because it's full. We know it's full. Someone once said to me, and I can't remember who, I think it was somebody who lived at Chikoji a long time ago, told me that that when you give something away, it actually makes space in your life to receive something in return, so that you don't have to worry about parting with things. That was kind of a beautiful way to look at giving. Embracing abstention is just like another way of just letting go of this desire to want things. That, you know, we don't really, if we're, sometimes we get afraid of like not having what we think we need. But if we practice some abstention, like maybe like skipping a meal, skipping dinner on a regular basis, which is actually showing to have huge health benefits, by the way. That abstention can help us strengthen this muscle of bounty within ourselves rather than lack. And the Heart Sutra itself talks about the Prajna Paramita is a state of no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, and so forth, until no realm of mind consciousness. So that in a way can be seen as abstention, a temporary abstention, which is in itself nirvana. That's the definition of nirvana, this state of Prajna Paramita. So it all comes down to letting go, and actually even letting go of this story of the self that we carry, the self that needs this or that. We can spend some time on our cushions letting go of our story of ourself. Maybe we'll be able to enjoy what we do have and be free a little bit from the anxiety and fear that we live with when every time we read the news. Or maybe I live with, I can only speak for myself, but anyway. I will finish by reading the last part of the Phukan Zazengi. Dogen says, "Please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. Devote your energies to a way that directly indicates the absolute. Revere the person of complete attainment who is beyond all human agency. Gain accord with the enlightenment of the Buddhas. Succeed to the legitimate lineage of the ancestors Samadhi. constantly perform in such a manner, and you are assured of being a person such as they. And then finally, he says, your treasure store will open of itself, and you will use it at will. Thank you. So now we can open it up to discussions. The discussion, any comments or questions or insights that anyone would like to share, please do so. If you want to speak, just put your hands in Gassho. And I'm the co-host, so I can call on you. Yes, Don Hopkins. Let's see, see if I can unmute you. Okay.
I just wanted to thank you. That was a very enjoyable talk. I got a lot out of what you said. And I just wanted to speak to what you said sort of in the beginning about growing up in the difficulties. We were sort of neighbors. I went to Los Altos High School maybe 6 or 7 years before you graduated, but I did have friends at Gunn and Pally. And right now I'm reading the Zen of Kodo Sawaki. And it's a great book. Obviously, you know, Koban learned from Kodo Sawaki, but I've been reading sort of constantly in there, either Kodo or Uchiyama, basically saying that the students that are being forced into this competitive nature in Japan are killing themselves and they're terribly unhappy. And it seems like all we're doing is sending these people through a grinding mill to come out so that they can get a better job and make more money. And I don't see that ever not happening, you know, at least in the mainstream of what we have in society right now. And I think it's really problematic. So it's wonderful to be able to step back and find some sort of way for, you know, some people it's going to be religion or meditation or whatever it is. But I really understand what you were saying. And I sort of had the same problem myself. And just I stopped going to school and got high on LSD all the time. But once I found Buddhism and the Dhammapada, everything changed for me. And honestly, school wasn't the answer for me. But I really enjoyed what you said, and I just wanted to tell you that I communicated with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I love that book by Kodo Sawaki and Uchiyama Roshi. And now the latest version has, I'm sorry, my brain isn't, the Shoho Okumura's commentary on it as well.
Yeah, that's the one. Yep.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. And thank you for sharing your experiences too. Yes, Kathy.
Oh, well, I think in a way, Don took a lot of the words out of my mouth. I felt very, very deep gratitude for your intimate sharing. And it's wonderful to hear a person who is no longer ashamed of their suffering, no longer ashamed to share what they've gone through. And I took all kinds of notes. I mean, there were wonderful things that you said. And especially the part about you didn't use the word generosity, but I remember reading that generosity is the antidote for feeling like you're not enough, or stinginess, or any of the above. And so I felt like as I was listening to you, every time you made another point, I'm like, yeah, yeah, I've experienced that, and it was wonderful. And I'm looking forward to this afternoon too, because I've read the first few chapters of the book, and it's wonderful too. So, but I just wanted to say thank you, my dear Connie.
Thanks, Kathy. For those of you who don't know what Kathy is referring to, we're going to do science and Buddhism at 2 this afternoon, and it's based on the book I'm focused on is this book by Hope Yaron called The Story of More, where she talks about how we got to climate change and what we can do about it. It's a big subject, definitely. And Dawn, I just wanted to go back to what you said about kids and their competitiveness, you know, the competitiveness in the school system. And I think that it's so important for us, you know, who have children to nurture them in such a way that they feel like they can follow their hearts. And find, you know, like we all want them to be successful in the world, but I don't have kids myself, but I'm inspired by Doug, who has 4 boys who all like followed their hearts, and a lot of them they're all musicians, though only a couple of them make their living that way. But having that, having somebody to tell you, you know, you're good already, you know, as you are, is really important.
Agree.
Yes, Kabe.
Connie, thank you so much for this really honest and from your heart Dharma talk. Thank you. And I want to say, I feel like your brother. I didn't steal your books or lend you books, but you know, I also came to Buddhism through the path of depression later in life than you. But I want to say also acknowledge, like I was on antidepressants. I almost died falling off a cliff 700 feet in Yosemite. And then a friend of mine gave me a book by Joko Beck and said, why don't you take a look? And I read it and I was blown away. And then he said, there's a Zen center close by. So we went together. And I remember that community. It was an older woman practitioner. She wasn't my formal teacher, but she was actually my teacher, my heart teacher. She was my age now then. And when she first met me, she asked me, what brings you here? I don't know why I'm saying all this, never mind. But anyway, thank you. Thank you. So I just want to say people really supported me in that community, which I left subsequently. And that's also a very important aspect of the path, the companionship that people see you for who your true self, in a sense, not what the world tells you you are, what the stories you tell yourself. Early on, somebody in a Dharma talk said, when I was over there, said, no creature fails to cover the ground on which they stand. And that always like really touched me, because like it meant to me like everybody has their own value. You know. Anyway, I rambled on, but thank you. Thank you so much. And the spoon is very shy. Your Oreo King stretch.
Pamela.
Bonnie, thank you. It was very poignant and powerful and moving, and I really admire your openness and vulnerability and willingness to just be Connie, which is just delightful. And I'm grateful for your talk today. I wanted to just ask questions a little bit about perfection and being enough and, you know, our negativity bias about, you know, we have so much and yet our brain wants to look at the stuff we don't have. And I wonder if you think that the way in to help all beings and to help our planet and our ocean, that the piece that starts on the cushion is about taking care of ourselves first, like really taking care of ourselves, finding out that we're enough, that we just are enough and that there is enough, so we can stop grasping for something outside of ourselves, so that we can stop shopping, so that we can stop consuming in the way we consume that creates so much waste. And I mean, I know you're going to say, yes, of course, that's the answer. But I sometimes feel like people get on the cushion and they want something out of the cushion that is not that, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it seems to me that that is really what we're doing there, is to answer, well, I'm fond of saying the koan of your own life, you know, the koan of your life, which is how to know that it's already enough already. It's ample, it's plenty, actually, you and everybody else in the world, in the face of the entire universe saying it's not enough, you're not enough, you're not good enough all the time. And I think women get a special dose of that about our appearance and how we are as mothers and if we work or don't work, if we have kids or don't have kids, all of that, it's a special layer. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts were about the cushion being the place where we're really honest with ourselves and put down all of the desires for more from ourselves and from the world.
Yeah. Thank you, Pamela. Well, all of those things that you say, they're all like our judging mind, you know, judging, you know, like, oh, I'm not good. I'm, you know, and even the people who want something out of practice, there's a judgment there that they aren't doing the real work. But Dogen says the way is perfect and all pervading. What point is there? What is the point of practice and realization? So that's a big question. That's a very old, you know, 800 years ago, that's what he was pondering. And I think everybody's, you know, if somebody's made it to the cushion in the first place, then they're going to be with themselves, however they are, you know, if they're wanting something out of that experience, life will throw something at them for sure. Never are we able to really none of us really know what we want, do we? I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe I just can't answer it other than, you know, we just need to put down, let go of our judgments. And also, I think it's important, like, not to just always just sit, you know, like, focus on our breath and our hara. Our hara is like another brain, but our heart is also another brain center. So I think both of them are important for placing our awareness when we're sitting or doing whatever.
Yes, and I want to add that I'm not separating myself from those people. I am those people. Absolutely. Thank you.
Tova, did you have a question?
I was just bowing, but I'm happy to speak too. I appreciate your candid chronology. You went you know, from teen years, starting with Dogen. You started with Dogen, then went back to your teen years. I was looking at how you moved through your time with us and appreciated that. So you began and ended with Dogen and then had your very personal experiences in the middle. So the clarity with which you speak touches me and does clarify what we're going through now with a big view, with the mega view. And I think the two things that touched me most were beyond just having a sense of who you are and from where you speak, your sense of the planet, the environmental challenges that we deal with, and the deep sense of tragedy that I feel all the time now, just taking a walk, because I'm picking up, you know, pieces of plastic. I'm sticking all this junk in my own pocket in the middle of the pandemic because it's on the ground. I mean, how can you not pick up all that stuff? And when you look at the science of it, as you spoke to, I believe it. And it just causes me tremendous pain. So what do we do? And where does that pain go? And then you speak of the hara. And for me, that's where it's gone. So I have to sit and ask, why am I taking this in? And what is it doing to me? And how am I and Mother Earth responding in tandem? And I gave up plastic. I don't bring plastic into the house. I don't take it to the market. I don't accept it from the market. I've been doing that for years, but you're right. It's harder now with the pandemic. So we have a big challenge, and our grandchildren, if we have them, are stepping into those waters, literally boogie boarding in those waters. And what are we going to do? And so we sit and we have each other.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. Emmy. Hello.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Connie. Thank you so much for reminding us why we go to the cushion. And to let go of our minds, to let go of ourselves. I too have those questions about how we can best look after our oceans. And it also makes me think how can we best look after our food. In our health and our land. And then I know it brings us back to the cushion, but thanks for bringing that up too. I just, every turn to questions, I guess, but I got a lot out of your talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Karn. Yeah, you're muted. Let's see if we can get you unmuted. There we go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions. First of all, thank you so much for your talk. And this was regarding the Dogen story that you started, that he raised his question to himself that we are already one and we are already part of this whole and we are part of the Dharma, then what is the need for practice? And that this question took him to China. And so I wanted to know, like, what was the answer? Like, what was the how did he answer that question when he came back, or like when he wrote? So that was the first one. And the second one was largely for everybody, because a few people mentioned about competition and our school systems and our society structured in a way to produce, structured in this grind that everybody is made to go through. And then we come out of it to do jobs and make money. And so regarding all of that, I just wanted to take everyone's perspective on why is that bad, or what are the downsides of such a system and such a society?
Well, Karin, in answer to your first question, I think the answer is with Dogen, that that was probably the koan that he carried with him his whole life. So much so that he puts it right in front of the Fukan Zazengi as his, you know, like his instructions to sit, you know, like, why do we sit, you know? But he did meet his heart teacher in China and come back and found Soto Zen in Japan, which is based on Shikantaza, which is, you know, the practice of just sitting. So I think maybe that's the answer, is we just sit. And then as to the competitive system for education, that's a really good question. And I think one of the answers for me that I feel is something that a lot of people feel, which is we need more teachers, better training for teachers, better pay for teachers, that a lot of the money that we put into military programs, et cetera, should go into education. That would really help with a lot of the social justice inequalities that we have in this country. And I think if there's more education out there, then the need for the, you know, if education's more available, more affordable, then the competition doesn't have to be so intense, because it'll just be available if you want it. You don't have to beat somebody else to get that prime slot. I don't know, what do other people think? Pamela?
Well, what I want to say is what's wrong with the system is that it stresses a perfect kind of realization of education. And I think perfection is the killer of creativity. Mm-hmm. Creativity is how the world moves forward, whether it's in the sciences or the arts. Creativity is where people think of new ways to solve problems, right? If you are taught that there's a perfect ideal answer and it looks like this, and this is how you better damn well answer it, because that's how you get your A and you get into Harvard and you get to be God, then you have put a big lid on the creative experience of problem solving. And problem solving is how we move forward. So I'm on a rant about this because I see a lot of young people who are really damaged by it. And I'm always trying to say, learn for the sake of learning because you love it. You know, do that piece because that's how problem solving arises. And the other part about Dogen, I thought that Dogen was kind of frustrated with his teachers in Japan because they were always stressing, you know, Kensho, enlightenment. Enlightenment is all what it's about. And he went to China, and in China they said, just sitting. Just sitting is enlightenment. And then his realization in China was that this is it, Shikantaza, this is it. Just this moment is enlightenment. Just every time you are in this moment, that was the answer to Dogen's question, I thought. But please set me straight.
Anyone? Kaveh?
Yeah, I mean, Pamela's answer was beautiful. I was thinking of something else before that, so I'll just say it. But from my personal experience, you know, I work in high tech. I go through a lot of anxiety. It's not about getting ahead in my mind. It's about surviving in that meat grinder. And I remember it's a story that it's something that happened to me. I remember, and it fits in with the non-gaining mind that we talk about so much in Zen, in Soto Zen, and also in Heart Sutra, with nothing to attain, you know. And this is the heart of Dogen's teaching. You know, I remember about a decade ago, I was going to this Whole Foods place in Sebastopol in Sonoma County, close to where I live. And I ran into this old, I think he must have been from Nepal or someplace. His name was Pasang. And immediately I was struck by how peaceful this man was. And he was kind of pure. His job was to clean the toilets, and his job was to like keep the store in order. And he would do such a beautiful job. I mean, the toilets were like, you know, like, I don't know, Whole Foods, you know, it was extremely clean, never since he left. And I just was like, who is this man? And I would see him sit outside, and he would take his lunch was a big bowl of soup. And he was just smiling at people and just really content. So I talked to him. I was trying to see if he's Dharma master. And his English wasn't good, but he understood me. And he said, no. And he left at some point. But that really stayed with me, that encounter with him, like his being. So that's the problem with our education system and with our gaining mind. Because it creates, that's another problem with it. Besides the environmental issues that you talked about, it's what it damage it does to us, to all the people who even get into Harvard and become perfect, this and that. Suzuki Roshi calls it the gaining mind, the step ladders, and today I'm this much, tomorrow I want to be this much. There's no end to that game. There's no end to that game. And the Shikantaza of Dogen is about giving all that up and sitting for the sake of sitting on the cushion. And then it frees you when you do that, if you can do that, which I can't a lot of times, but sometimes it magically happens. At that time, you yourself feel in your body and mind, your heart, that you're released, because you're not looking for more. So the system is set up to show us that we lack and enemy.
Let's see.
I remember once hearing that the purpose of marketing is to transmit the message that you suck. And I think that's so true. And I remember having, when I was a therapist, I remember having this five-year-old client who was being, no, fifth grade client who was being raised by her grandparents, who said, well, unless you improve your grades in fifth grade, how do you expect to get into Harvard? And I said something dismissive of that, and that was the end of being her therapist. But I also remember, in my humble narrative, my ex-husband, father of my children, was sort of verbally abusive. And I know now, looking back at it, that he was very hurting. But I remember one time 10, 15 years later, talking to my son and saying, you know, you're really a wonderful person. And he said, Mom, that sure beats you suck. And maybe saving all sentient beings is just saying in some way or another, you're a wonderful person.
Yeah. You're a wonderful person. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Yes. To follow up on what Kathy just said, and what also has been said by Pamela and Covey about education, you know, I'm optimistic about the future of education, having seen where it was in the 60s when I was in high school to some of the mindsets of today. And having in some of my experience, I've noticed that there's a lot of teachers that see this fundamental fact, which is there are all kinds of smarts. With that understanding of that there are all kinds of smarts, that opens it up to every kid in every class to see where there are smarts, where their abilities are, where their proclivities are, where their propensities are. And it's and so I think, you know, there are all these different kinds of systems, but with that kind of understanding, that if parents can have that understanding, if teachers can have that kind of understanding, it's just a way more generous way that allows more stuff to happen and kids to do well at what they're good at. Not that they don't have to learn, you know, there is going to be competition because there is on the soccer field and there is in a spelling bee, but there's also the opportunities to not compete and to be fully who they are. And as Kathy said, you're a wonderful person. And to be able to say that in some way, even if it's to say to a young kid who's a troublemaker in class, boy, you tie your shoes really nicely today. And just be able to say something positive like that. So, I just wanted to bring up that there are all kinds of smarts: heart smarts, gut smarts, intellectual smarts, physical smarts. You know, and we all have different assortments of them. So may we honor that and respect that in all beings.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Oh, Alvin. Hi, Alvin, you're unmuted.
Hi. I really appreciate the chat. This is my first time. I actually joined you guys, I think, last time a couple months ago, and then I went away to New York and now I'm back, and I remember you guys had this Sunday service, so I wanted to join in. Just going off of, this is just going to be a cluster of everything combined with little bits and pieces of what everyone was talking about, but I think in terms of meditation, one of the things that as I explored Buddhism, meditation to me is a way of cleansing the mind and pulling back so that we always find the balance between, small mind and big mind. Small mind meaning your own personal self, your ego, the character that you built up as a child. You're a white piece of paper and everyone tells you you're supposed to do this, do that, how to be a part of society. And meditation to me helps me kind of clear that self, a way to kind of get closer to that white piece of paper again, where I think about big mind, which is, you know, the world, universality, how the world is really one unit. And I think that education today, where we find challenge is that in the schooling system, we're taught about how to improve our grades and how to become a part of society and do better and do better and do better. But where we don't really keep in mind is how to balance the growing person's being so that they take the perspective of small mind, the individual, the ego, and compared to the big mind, which is, you know, universality and the world in general, and going to consumption versus contribution. I only actually need to eat a bowl of porridge, something simple to nourish myself, so that then, how do I then refocus? How do I contribute to the world around me? Someone was talking about picking up garbage on the ground or in the grocery store, that grocery man that was providing, you know, really clean toilets at Whole Foods or things like that. It's to think, okay, I ate something simple. I don't need to eat a prime rib, but I ate something simple to nourish myself. So that now, how do I contribute to those around me? And as you continue exercising that way of balancing your mind through meditation of the small mind with the big mind and combining all that as one unit, I think that if each individual through the education system, we somehow bake that way of thinking and mindfulness into the education system, which I don't see right now. If we do that, that'll help out just everyone. So thank you.
Thank you. That's a really good, that's really important. It's really important. It's, I think that's I see that too in education, is that it's all about, oh, you know, you've got to get things for yourself and not very much about being part of a team, or doing something, to benefit others. So, that's really a big reason why I think there's a lot of unhappy teenagers out there. Anyone else?
Right. Yes, Connie, maybe we should close for this session because at 2 o'clock we have Science of Buddhism from 2 to 3:30 or 2 to 4. And Nico, is that posted on the website, the Science and Buddhism? Yes, okay. So please join us for that. And next Saturday, we have a Zazen Kai from 9 to 4:30 or 5 o'clock that Connie and I will lead. And so please join us for that. And then next Sunday, we have our Sunday program again. And please, join us when you can. It's very good to see everyone here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.